session number 4841, reel 2.
Major PT, reel 2.
I tried to follow much the same line of thought as we had in Changi, and to get things going in one way or another in Mukden amongst ourselves. I must say that the British and the Americans tended to keep to their own people very much in these early days. But, for example, one of my officers, Peter Lester, he was a geologist by profession, searching for oil around Borneo and so on, for the Dutch Shell Company, I think it was. And he used to give talks on geology. And it was surprising the number of men who would come and listen to talks on geology who you would never have thought would have any interest in the subject at all, but it was a fact that there was a talk on that evening. And similarly, his hobby was astronomy, and he used to give talks on astronomy because you get a wonderful clear sky there and you could be outside and actually point at the various stars. And there were American sailors also captives, and some of them really wanted to study navigation by the stars, and others were just interested to know that that was Sirius, or that was a star which we used to call Betelgeuse. It's got some other name. And music, of course, was something which could be made interesting. While we were in this hutted camp at Mukden, the Japanese said they'd had a grant from the Vatican, and what would we like them to buy for us. And they bought two violins and two guitars, and I'm not sure whether they bought a piano accordion or whether this corporal of the engineers who played it had brought it with him from Singapore. But we had the nucleus of a little band, and a lot of it was just playing by ear, a little bit more than the Knees Up Mother Brown type of thing, but the popular songs and tunes of the day were brought out or produced. And I've always been interested in music myself, so I set to work to try to write out music for this skeleton band. A lot of it, writing out, had to be done just on toilet paper, but still, it meant that you could get two violins playing first and second violin instead of just playing by ear, both playing the melody. And we got a little sort of male voice choir going, about eight of us, I think. And we would go through some of these old traditional songs like Green Grow the Rushes Home, the 12 Days of Christmas, and various songs like that, but we did them in harmony. And we got a lot of amusement and interest in getting together our little sort of shows like that, camp sing songs. And other interests were, of course, how to outwit the Japanese. That was really the most amusing thing that you could do, was to try and think of some way of outwitting the Japanese.
How did you do it?
Oh, it was mostly concerned with smuggling. We got quite a lot of things in and out of the camp. The sentries were sometimes not unfriendly, and I remember the first Christmas that we were there, I persuaded one of the camp guards to bring in 200 cigarettes, a whole carton of cigarettes, for which I traded a shirt or something like that. And that would be two cigarettes for each of my chaps on Christmas Day. Oh, they got caught, and I got 10 days confined to barracks for breaking the violations. As I couldn't get out anyhow, it really wasn't much of a penalty. But I went through all the solemn rigmarole of a Japanese court-martial to sentence me to 10 days CB for violating prison camp rules. It makes me laugh when I think back.
Did the Japanese seem to punish their own soldiers by such methods, or was it just physical?
we only saw the physical side of it. They could beat up their own men for breaking some ridiculous little rule just as easily as they would beat up a prisoner of war. One thing that was strange was you were not allowed to smoke in the open. If you were smoking at all, you had to be indoors and holding an ashtray in your hand. Well, sometimes a man would be caught smoking on his way to the latrines, or actually in the latrines, and he would then get beaten up. And I've seen Japanese guard beaten up. For what the reason was, I don't know, but they beat him up with a baseball club. And there were two Japanese interpreters there, one called Waku and the other one Noda. And I said, why is it that you beat up people like this? It's quite different from our way of living. And it was old Waku, who was a Japanese schoolmaster. He explained to me that when you're born in Japan, you get a birth certificate, just as we do in England. But you carry that with you as your sort of curriculum vitae the whole of your life. And every commendation is put down on your birth certificate, and so is every infringement of the code, and that is done in red ink. And I explained that if you go and apply for a job anywhere, you've got to show your birth certificate with all its entries, endorsements, you might say. And if there's some in red ink, you just don't get the job. So they think it's much better to beat a man up and use corporal punishment rather than blot his copybook for what might be the rest of his life. So there's a queer sort of logic in our reasoning. And this was a turning point for me in this sense, that once I realized that they had a reason for everything they did, if I could think of the opposite way to what I thought myself, I would very likely be thinking the same way as they were. The whole code of manners and thought is perfectly reasonable, but it's the opposite to ours. If I can sort of digress for a moment, when you're in a Chinese house or a Japanese house and you're invited to a meal, they expect you to take the best that you can see on the table. We would leave the titbits for our host, but they expect you to take it because that shows that you are a man of discrimination and you know what good things are being offered to you. In the same way, when you take a cup of tea, you take it with both hands, which indicates that you don't want to risk spilling a drop of this beautiful tea. And you make a lovely slurp when you drink it to show just how much you're enjoying it. And when you've finished your meal, if you can produce a really hearty belch, that shows just how much you really appreciated the things that your host offered you. These are things which we would consider rude here, but it's their way of doing it.
You've talked about the Japanese attitude towards POWs, but could you understand from the time you spent with your Japanese captors what their attitude seemed to be towards you as Westerners or Englishmen?
I think that the outstanding thing was that they kept on saying to me that I've got to search for the word. It's not aggressive. I have to find the word. It's gone from my moment at the moment. Can you think of it? They always used to accuse me of being arrogant, and Westerners in general were arrogant. And I think that this is probably because a lot of them had been in very menial positions or had come up against Western employers who taken rather the attitude which I think used to exist in India, you know, clap your hands and call boy and somebody would come running. And I think that some of the Japanese officers were temporary soldiers, and one, I feel pretty sure, had worked in a shipping office. And he'd probably been ordered about by some European boss and was only too ready to take it out on us. On the other hand, there were some Japanese who were as good as you could expect them to be in the circumstances. There was a Lieutenant Hitchy Carter who had been educated at Cambridge, and he'd lived with a family in Bedfordshire for 3 years. And he would walk around the camp with his hands in his pockets and say, I wonder who's going to win the boat race this year. And he was a very good chap. I would like to mention him later on in another sort of connection. But because he spoke such fluent English and had lived with English people, I always felt I could talk to him even more than I could to the Americans, in many ways. And when we were pretty down on rations, I would say to him, I would like to an interview with the commandant with a view of getting increased rations or a variation in the diet. And he'd say, well, don't do that. He will take it as meaning that you think he's not doing his job properly and he will be offended. He said, let me mention it when I think the time is right in our own quarters. And sure enough, in 2 or 3 days, we might get an ounce or two more of this or that, and the food would improve a little bit. The other person that I would particularly like to mention, because it's in my mind at the moment, is a Dr. Oki, who came right towards the end of the event. I know that he went down into the town of Mukden and spent money out of his own pocket to get things to alleviate the dysentery in Beriberi, where the so-called hospital lacked. I was told that he got opium. Having no medical knowledge, I don't know whether this would do anybody any good or not. But Lieutenant Hitchy Carter and Dr. Oki were two quite good people. And I think I'd better clear them out of my mind while it is in my mind, because one tends to ramble as one goes on. When the end came, after being moved to a properly built camp in Mukden, I was able to see the senior Russian officer there. I think his name was Vasilyevsky. But I could speak Russian at that time, and I particularly gave him details of what Lieutenant Hitchy Carter and Dr. Oki had done for us. And when the end came, all the Japanese camp staff were pushed away into their own quarters, but a large Russian car came with a Russian officer, and they took Hitchy Carter and Oki away in this private car. So I've always hoped that they were picked out and not sort of put in the bunch who were going to be just shoved around anywhere. Equally, while it's in my mind, I can say there was Lieutenant Mickey, who was an absolute bastard. We all hated him like anything. And this is the one who I think had been in the shipping office. And a Corporal Noder, who had been educated in America, and he again was a spiteful, vicious man. Mickey used to delight in roll call, telling everybody to hold out their hands, and if he saw any dirt under the fingernails, he would just bash them on the head with a baseball club. And I've seen him go down a row of men to see if he could knock 12 out just for the pleasure of exercising his strength.
You mean knock them unconscious?
Yes, knock them unconscious. Well, I also gave this Marshal Vasilyevsky details about Mickey and Noda. And the sting in the tail is that after I got back to England, I had a letter from an American Sergeant Hurley, who was actually Russian-born, sending me a copy of the San Francisco Sun. And it was a little it was a cutting from this paper. And it said, Lieutenant Mickey Toro, one-time officer at Mukden Prisoner of War Camp, was today executed for brutality to prisoners of war. Now, how that came about was that the staff at the factory where the men were working had passed the news that this man, Mickey, had gone to Shanghai. And I think fate caught up with him there through the Russian Vasilyevsky. I mean, he was executed as a war criminal.
Could we say something more now, in more detail, about your treatment in general by the Japanese? Did they ever execute anyone?
Yes, three men were executed. While we were in this hutted camp in Mukden, three American Marines were missing on roll call one evening. And, the upset was terrific. The Japanese adjutant, Ishikawa, came out and made a long speech, which was translated to us, saying they were going to dig a well, they were going to push us all down the well and put the lid on it, and he was going to sit on the lid to see that nobody else got out. But in the actual event, they took 10 men from each barrack hut where the three who escaped had been. So that was 30 men, and they were all made to sit all day long cross-legged as a punishment from one of their number having escaped from their hut, what they called sitting at attention. And we all, of course, wondered what was happening, and many of us had thought of trying to escape. But what hope is there 400 miles from any coastline in a country where everybody has oriental eyes and black hair and you're white-faced and got fairish hair? I mean, there was no real hope of anybody getting away, in my opinion. Nobody else ever tried it. But then, one day, the Japanese came in great triumph with these three men. They had captured them about 50 miles away. They'd been trying to travel by night and living on potatoes and turnips grubbed up in farmers' fields and things like that. But the Japanese said that they had absconded in spite of all the loving care which the Japanese had given them. And this was an insult to the emperor. And we were then officially informed that all three had been shot. They were taken around the camp and made to show just where they got out under the wire, and then the Japanese put more wire there, and I think they probably doubled up their guards. But those were the only three people who were actually deliberately killed. Of course, there were many who died of simply of illness, of dysentery, beriberi, and so on.
Can you tell me about what the Japanese provision in the way of medical facilities was?
Well, I understand it was very, very meagre. We had three doctors. There was a Japanese doctor, two American doctors, and one Australian doctor formed the staff. We had two or three fellows from the RAMC, and there were plenty of people who volunteered to go and look after the sick, mostly British, strangely enough, but there were some American orderlies as well. But the doctors, Dr. Shabbat and Dr. Brennan, and the other doctor whose name I can't think for the moment, they all said there was practically nothing there. The medicines were primitive. If you felt pretty bad and went to see the doctor, you might be lucky to get a half an aspirin tablet. And there was a time when I contracted mumps, of all the stupid things to get when you're over 40, and the only cure that I got for it was a long strip of cellophane tied like a scarf under my chin and up with tied with a bow on the top of my head to keep the swelling in place. And no medicine of any sort whatever, but I was isolated so as not to spread mumps as an infectious disease, and that was absolutely the only treatment I had at all. And I never saw any medicines in that hospital at all, but there must have been some.
You've said that one of their punishments was beatings and this sitting to attention that you had. What other punishments did they have?
Oh, to stand with your arms out in front of you at 90 degrees holding weights of various sorts. And then as soon as your arms began to flag, get beaten up. But they used to put people in the guardhouse and take away most of their clothing, and cold was the punishment. This bitter cold when you're only half clothed, and they would put people in the brig, as the Americans call it, and leave them just practically to freeze, well, not freeze to death, but to go through the misery of intense cold. That was a favourite sort of thing in the winter. And they were bestial in other ways. I remember a case of an old woman. We could see it only had a post and wire fence around. An old woman was gathering sticks, presumably for her own fire, and she came a little bit closer to the camp than the guards thought that she should. So they tied her hands behind her back and made her squat down at the foot of a tree and tied the rope around the tree and kept her sitting there tied to the tree all day long. It's not a nice thing to do to an old woman. Must have been over 70. But another thing, example of that bestiality, was the latrines were dreadful. I mean, it was nothing but a bog hole, literally, and sat on a pole. But they had the Manchus come in and supposed to clean them out every so often. And I think in Victorian days, they used to call it the night cart. They'd come in, and I can remember one case that I saw myself when Manchu came in with a mule cart, and just as they were coming past the guardhouse, the mule did a whoopsie on the ground, and the sentries made the mule driver pick it up, put it in his hat, and eat it. And that was absolutely revolting.
Did you yourselves ever make any contact with the Manchu population in the way that people had, you said, had managed to trade with the Malays in Changi?
Well, yes, the men who went to work did, but for my own part, you see, the only time I ever went out that camp was to the cemetery for a funeral. But about 600, 500 or 600 men were going to work at a nearby factory. As far as I know, it had been a Ford assembly plant in Manchuria before the Manchuria incident in 1932, and the Japanese were rehabilitating it and making it into a machine tool factory. And again, as far as I know, nothing that ever been made there ever worked, because the men were wonderfully good at mucking things up, sabotage in a way. But the first thing apparently was that they were installing new machinery, taking out old machinery and installing new machinery. And whenever they found anything like micrometers or vernier gauges or anything like that, they went in to reinforce the concrete that was bedding in the new machinery. The Japanese were making replicas of things that are quite well known. I remember Singer sewing machines that used to have a cast iron stand and treadle operation, and they had the word Singer cast in the framework. And the Japanese cut the leg off the R, so the word became Singep, and were trying to sell these things as Japanese sewing machines. But they were absolute copies of the Singer sewing machine. But the only thing was that when they were doing casting or anything like that, our men always managed to get some sand into the molten metal. And so when they tried machining the things, the tools broke, or the casting was full of potholes and bubbles with sand. As I say, I don't think anything ever worked that came out of that factory.
Did you ever hear what kind of contact those who went out on work parties managed to make with the Manchus?
Well, the language was a great problem. There was a Captain Horner, a New Zealander, who went with the working parties every day, and he was supposed to sort of keep the payroll and the accounts, because the Japanese paid, I think it was 10 sen a day to each man who went to work. And I think it was 15 sen a day for NCOs and 25 sen a day for officers.
The 100 sen to the yen.
100 sen to the yen. So that was about, 2p, 3p, and 4.5 or 5p a day. In old pence, not modern pence. But this, where you were allowed to spend at... they called the canteen. They did have a sort of shop. If you had the money, you could buy cigarettes, a particular variety called kamikaze, which we all thought were made of the stub ends of cigarettes.
Because they're really called kamikaze?
I don't know. The men always called them kamikaze cigarettes. It was always said that the beggars there used to go along with a sort of a pin in the end of a bamboo and pick up the stubs of cigarettes, and seven of those cigarettes would then be remade into one kamikaze, which was sold to us. And seven kamikaze stub ends would then go on to some even more deadly sort of cigarette. But you could also sometimes get something like a marzipan is the way you could describe it. It was made of soya beans, and I think it was called yokum. But it was sweet, and it was like marzipan. It was fairly filling. And being soya bean, it must have had protein in it. But although everybody was hungry, when I look back, there was nobody that was really starving. It was a process of gradual deterioration, because when I came out at the end, I weighed only 83 pounds. So I just sort of gradually whittled away.
What was your normal weight?
11 stone. That's 11, 14, 154 pounds, down to 83. And it was pitiful to see really big men who'd sometimes lost as much as 8 stone, you know. Man of 16 stone coming down to 8's a pretty skeleton sort of thing. Unfortunately, your skin doesn't contract at the same time that your flesh does, and you become all baggy and horrible. But this Captain Horner that I mentioned, you see, he had a sort of a liaison with a Chinese foreman who spoke a little English, at least the numbers. They could always count the numbers and check up that the right number of men had gone into the factory and the same number had come out. But
did the Manchus seem to be friendly towards the POWs?
Yes, the Manchus helped in almost any way that they could, as long as it wasn't risking them in too much trouble. There was a thriving sort of trade went on underhand somewhere or other, and I thought that it was probably best that I didn't know too much about it. It was one of these peculiar sort of things that went on, but I know that 19 one-horsepower electric motors were smuggled out of that factory and sold somewhere or other down the town, because men came back with money. And the one much larger electric motor was sold somewhere or other. But the Japanese method of stock keeping or stock control was simply to see on the stock record cards that the issues and receipts balanced one another. And as long as the mathematics was all right, they assumed that the motors were there. They never accused us of having stolen anything.